But last week, Four Corners episode focused on relationships between ministers and staffers and an alleged culture of sexism faced by women in Parliament. It dominated Australian political news, with some even calling it Australian Parliament's hashtag MeToo moment. Here to discuss what it's like for women in Australian politics is Dr. Maria Taflaga, a lecturer in political science at ANU and recent recipient of an Australian Research Council grant for her joint project, Pathways to Power, Political Careers in Australia. Maria, how are you? Thanks for joining the show.
Yes, I'm doing well. Thank you.
Thank you. So currently there are complaints of misconduct in Parliament. They get handled by the Department of Finance. Online, you've shown you think this is to be ever so slightly ineffective. Could you explain how the current complaint system impacts women in Parliament?
Yes. So think about it like this. You are employed by one entity, in this case, the Department of Finance, but your boss is actually employed by the Australian people, not the Department of Finance, and you lodge a complaint with the Department of Finance, and the Department of Finance has actually no capacity to sanction your boss, and in fact, your boss is the person who hires or fires you on 0 hours notice. So that is the problem in a nutshell. So essentially, the complaints process, not only is it not very clear or in exactly how it kind of will function or operate, sexual harassment provisions were only added last year to staffers' workplace sort of management framework, but ultimately any report that the Department of Finance produces actually just goes straight back to your boss, who ultimately has the capacity to decide and arbitrate on it, because staffers are employed directly by their bosses, which is an MP.
So is there no HR or something alike in Parliament? Is that why it goes to the, like you said, the like finance department?
Yes. So in a nutshell, no, that's correct, right? So political staff are not public servants. So they are hired under different legislation to all other public servants. So public servants obviously have access to a HR department, which is run by their department, and you know, even the deputy secretary or the secretary of that department is subject to that HR department. Whereas under the MOPS Act, it's quite clear that the MP is the hiring entity. And whilst there may be some oversight from other MPs, such as the Prime Minister, ultimately that is not sort of par for the course. And you might recall when Peter Credlin was sort of vetting staff of coalition cabinet ministers. That was a very politically fraught point. So that kind of oversight is not welcomed by political staff. And so, yes, there is effectively no HR department for staffers in particular, and the process run by the Department of Finance, which is also the same body that investigates travel routes and things like that, which we've all seen to be very effective investigations that have definitely gone places. So that's essentially the problem, that not only is the complaints process itself not terribly coherent, it's actually kind of asymmetric. There is no capacity for it, really any enforcement. It ultimately becomes a political decision on the part of party leaders.
Well, to that point, you did write in the conversation recently, there needs to be clearer and more effective mechanism for all staff to seek support and such. What would these kind of more effective measures and mechanisms potentially look like?
Right. So, yes, so there's been some movement towards different models around the world. And in general, these have been ones that have been run by Parliament itself. So bodies that can encompass and have sort of the capacity to resolve issues or deliver consequences to both actors involved, either the MP or staff members. However, I mean, one of the and they also stipulated far more clearly what the actual codes of behaviour that are expected. So at the moment, in the ministerial code of conduct, it says that you cannot have a sexual relationship with a staff member in your office, and that this would constitute a breach of the code. And that is pretty much it. So it doesn't preclude you from having relationships with other staff members in other people's offices. And if you are not a minister, then there is no rule. But you still have staff, right? You have electoral staff, for example. So a code of conduct would at least sort of go some way to sort of setting out a set of norms. You know, there would probably need to be a registration process for, you know, relationships. Like having a ban on relationships with your staff is definitely one strategy, but it might not necessarily be the most effective. You know, the Human Rights Commission has a lot of advice for businesses about how to manage these kinds of relationships that crop up in the workplace. For example, if I was to enter into a relationship with someone here in at the university, I would be required to register that relationship. However, there are some relationships that I think would just not be tolerated under any circumstances, for example, between like a lecturer and a student. And it could be the case that society standards have shifted such that relationships between staff, because of the power asymmetry, and ministers are just simply not acceptable anymore. The final thing you really need is a way to actually manage that asymmetry of power. So between the hiring agent, in this case the minister, and the subordinate, and that's kind of the problem with models in the UK and Canada. They still massively favour the minister. They're sort of geared towards effectively secrecy, resolving issues out of the public eye, and not necessarily perhaps having enough consequences for ministers or for MPs to sort of really rethink whether or not this is a good idea and whether or not they should behave differently in the workplace, given they are much more powerful than their subordinates.
Do you think there's a network culture or something to that point, getting jobs based on personal kind of relationships?
Absolutely.
To this point, maybe even kind of something slightly more unsavoury. But do you think or do you subscribe to the idea that there's an influence that women's access to positions and their ability to rise through the rank is kind of directly correlated with this?
So we know that politics is a patronage game. It always has been, right? You know, in the 19th century, it was, I'm the son of the Lord, or like the Lord owns this land, and I'm his chosen guy, so I'm going to win this seat because everyone's going to vote for the Lord's candidate. And today, it's more along the lines of, I've done this service for the party and have these, like, you know, allies within the party, or I work as a staffer for this minister or this shadow minister who is connected to this faction or this grouping, and that brings with it a whole bunch of sort of patronage and influence. And the way it sort of affects women is kind of twofold. So the first is that, like, we already know in Australia, looking at like basically career progression of political staff over time, looking at who gets promoted and what jobs they do, that in general, women are less likely to be proximate to ministers, so they're less likely to be in positions of power and influence closer to the minister, and that means they don't get the skills that make them more attractive as candidates compared to men. But this is changing. And the second factor is that we know that political parties are more so probably the Liberal Party today, but, you know, Labor was probably much worse in the past on this. You know, lots of politics or lots of deals are done informally at the pub. And, you know, if you're not in the right circles and you're not at the pub, then you're going to be missing out. And this was something that women tended to be sort of excluded from. And I guess what we've sort of seen with the Rochelle Miller case is that she had this consensual affair with a minister, and then the relationship ended, and she seems to have just been sort of like frozen out of the job that she had in a new office, basically made redundant, and then told that she wouldn't be qualified for the other job going in the office, and her subordinate was literally just replaced her.
So almost like a friendship group when someone breaks up with a partner, and then that partner, depending on where they were, kind of gets left in the lurch of sorts. Obviously, that's a pretty kind of watered down example, but almost similar to that. I feel like most people could resonate with that.
Yes, exactly. And that's basically the substance of her current complaint, which is before the Department of Finance. So, and to be clear, it's she's not alleging any form of sexual harassment. She is making a complaint about effectively what happened to her position and how she was effectively frozen out of a 8-year career where she was generally considered to be very good at her job because she had had an affair with a minister. And so, you know, she'd lost her job, the minister still has his job. And that's sort of, I guess, the point.
I see. Congrats, I should just say very quickly, on your recent grant that looks into kind of elite career paths. It says that the project hopes to examine the impact of political elites on the quality of government. Do you think, do you have any early thoughts, I suppose, on the current culture of Parliament and how this affects outcomes for, I guess, Australians or just the general public as a result of this?
So I do think it does impact on trust in the sense that I think for a lot of people, we were surprised to find out there's no HR department in Parliament.
Yeah, that's a wonder.
That exactly, and that, you know, for a lot of Australians, the idea of behaving in this way just seems ridiculous because that's a really good way to get fired, right? And yet there seems to be some resistance from some people on Parliament Hill that this is, you know, that this is an unfair amount of scrutiny on their behaviour, and it sort of basically goes down to the point about there's, you know, potentially one rule for the rest of us and another rule for politicians. So that's sort of that dimension. Mm-hmm. But in terms of quality of government, I guess what we really kind of mean here is the way that political careers have professionalised over time and their relationship to other branches of government, we suspect may have actually had an impact on the way policy is effectively produced and the way legislation is produced. There is some evidence from the United Kingdom that suggests that governments are amending their own legislation at a much higher rate than they did in the past. So they're finding mistakes that they've made, which suggests that the first lot of drafting perhaps wasn't as good, and that political considerations around marketing things perhaps might be driving stuff. So that's one branch of what we intend to do in this research.
Unfortunately, we have to move on, Marie, but thanks so much for joining the show. And again, congratulations on the grant. Hopefully it might get a little bit of exposure and have some positive steps going forward.
Thank you.
Cheers. Have a good week.
You too.
That was Dr. Maria Taflaga from the Australian National University sharing her thoughts on what the Canberra bubble looks like for women who work there. Dr. Taflaga has recently received an Australian Research Council grant for her joint project, Pathways to Power, Political Careers in Australia, that will touch on that.